This is the House Finance Committee meeting. It is Wednesday, February 9th, approximately 1:45 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time, Representatives Moses, Williams, Phillips, myself, Terrio, Bundy, Osterman, and Grusendorf. Before we get to back to consideration on House Bill 268, all the members were just handed a section of new language dealing with the charter school bill that we took action on the other day. There was a conceptual amendment that was passed, I believe it was amendment number 5, and we have been dealing with legislative auditor on drafting up suggested language on how to deal with that conceptual amendment. This section E here is their suggestion, which we now intend to take to the drafters. And I have Mike Tibbles here with Committee A just to go over a few of the changes that were suggested by the auditor. Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In attempts to deal with the complex issue of what should be itemized, direct, indirect, federal regulations, and accounting nightmares, burdensome restrictions, the discussion at the last meeting regarding inserting language tying this to a federal reg wasn't sufficient. So we've expanded a little bit to try to incorporate the intent of what the committee was trying to get at. And I have 5 bullet points here on the sheet that was handed out. I could point those out and real briefly run through those. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer those or provide examples on those maybe as I go through. But the first one would require itemization.
Okay, and Mike, this is to the charter school bill. There was one conceptual amendment that was passed, and we've been working with the legislative auditor, and then we're going to go to legal on fleshing out that conceptual amendment. So I just wanted to bring the committee up to speed on where we are on that discussion on that amendment, and just let you know that, you know, we're trying to iron out all the language before the bill proceeds on the rules. So with that, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first point under the summary of changes here, as you can see, we require itemization only if the district intends to charge the charter school for the service. I'll give a quick example. If the school district has an extra room for the charter school, and rather than setting up a whole new accounting to itemize for that, the cost for that, they could agree that we'll just go ahead and let you use the room. It's going to be easier and cheaper for us to just let you use this room than it is to try to figure out on a per pupil basis how much that the value of that benefit would be. So that would be the first change. Second would require the cost of the itemized services to be identified separately. I think that one's self-explanatory. The third one would require cost allocation method that conforms to the United States OMB Circular A87, and that's the dealing with the direct and the indirect, or based upon a mutually agreed method between the charter school and the school district. What we're trying to get at there is just there may be a methodology that's not necessarily included in the OMB circular that the charter school and the school district may agree on. I could give a quick example of OMB circular requires that if you're going to charge for personal services, that time be accounted for in a positive timekeeping manner. That means you have to count for every hour. You're just like punching the clock for that. A lot of the school districts use a negative time counting system where they say here's the amount and then deduct the hours that they aren't there. So it's a different system. Rather than requiring the OMB circular, in this particular instance, if it's already occurring, the charter school and the school district can agree that we'll continue with the methodology that we're using now. It's cheaper, it's easier to use, and we both can agree that's going to suit the purposes. The fourth one is just a clarification that administration is not a service that the charter school can elect to not receive. They have to include administration, and they have to receive those services. And the fifth one, we took out language district-wide programs and replaced that with services with benefits that are inseparable between the charter school and the school district. And when we were wrestling with what district-wide services meant, with all the examples that came up, were more of administration type things, electric, heat, janitorial services, that kind of stuff. So we think this language is working with audit, I should say, legislative audit. This language would more appropriately address that. If a charter school is in a school facility, that electric bill is the benefit of that electric bill is going to be the same for the charter school as it is for the regular school. So it's going to be inseparable. And if they're in their own facility, they're going to be paying a separate bill for that electric. So that would be separable. So we think that addresses that concern.
Okay. With that, again, this is just to keep you up to date on going discussion back and forth with Ledge Audit and Ledge Legal as we work out the details of that amendment on that section of the bill. Okay, with that, we'll now turn to House Bill 268. And let's see if we have Mr. Lynch and Mr. Manley on teleconference. Gentlemen, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Manley's here. This is Jim Lynch, and I'm here also.
Okay. We had the overview by Mr. Lynch the other day, and Mr. Manley, I'm sorry that we weren't able to get to the bill quick enough to get your testimony. I think at this point we can just go ahead and turn to you for your testimony on the bill. And then if members have questions, we'll get them asked and answered after you're done.
Thank you very much, and I apologize for the not being able to testify on previously. I simply had some engagement. I'm an estate planning and tax attorney with Hugh Sources, Powell Huddleston Endowment in Anchorage. I've been practicing in this area for about 25 years. I'm part of an informal group of other tax and estate planning attorneys that do pro bono work by assisting with technical review of legislation. I am not representing anyone regarding this bill, and I became interested in this type of legislation because in my estate planning practice, I was seeing clients send money outside of the state of Alaska to other college savings plans. And I've got to keep the money floating around for the benefit of the Alaska economy. Now, I think this bill is good for Alaskans, and it's good for the university. These college savings plans are called Section 529 plans because Internal Revenue Code 529 authorized the various states to adopt these kinds of programs. Forbes magazine called Section 529 the sleeper tax break of the 1997 Tax Act. And the thing to remember is that while each state can set up its own plan, there is no requirement that the money used for education by the beneficiary of these plans be used in the state where the plan is set up. So what you've got is all of the states in competition to offer the best program, which will bring investment into the state and may not necessarily increase university enrollment, but still provides an economic benefit to the university. Now, let me explain why it's good for Alaskans. First, it allows savings in anticipation of college expenses. And for income tax purposes, it works like an IRA. You have a tax-deferred compounding inside this qualified plan. Now, you don't get a tax deduction, an income tax deduction, when you make a contribution like an IRA, but you do get this benefit of income tax deferred compounding and accumulation. Like an IRA, the qualified plan or the savings plan withdrawals are going to be subject to income tax when there's a withdrawal. But usually students have a lower income tax bracket than their parents or their grandparents who are making the contribution. And under the new tax bill, all the various tax bills that are floating around in Congress right now, some of the proposals even call for the withdrawal from these kind of qualified plans to be totally income tax free, provided they're used for qualified higher education expenses. Now, the plan is also good from an estate gift tax point of view because it allows you to make a completed gift and still maintain some parental control. And completed gifts are important in the estate gift tax regime because that's how you get your $10,000 per recipient per year exclusion from gift taxes. And even better, with these kind of plans, you can forward, you can basically lump sum on a forward basis a 5 years worth of exclusion. So in other words, you could put $50,000 in one lump sum and not have any resulting taxable gift. You have to live for another 5 years to use up this future $10,000 allocation, but it allows you to front-end fund college education funds without estate gift tax funds. And, of course, husband and wife can each do that for their children. And the money that you put away for your children's college would be out of your estate for estate tax purposes. Now, this program is also advantageous because it's flexible. It's not income limited like Roth IRAs and other tax advantages. And you can put up to a total of $100,000 per beneficiary or possibly more in one of these funds. Now, the total maximum amount of contributions is uncertain. Federal law and regulations provide that it should be the total cost of higher education done inside the state sponsoring the program. And for example, Montana has calculated that at $172,000. A number of other states have used $100,000. It's all tied to educational costs. The other great thing about these programs is you have participant control. You put the money in initially for the benefit of your child, but you can change beneficiaries within the family if it turns out that one child is not going to pursue higher education. You could shift the beneficiary to other family members, or you can even pull the money out and take the money back. Now, if you do not use the money that's accumulated for higher education, there's a penalty. And that penalty can be as low as 10% of the earnings. It depends on each program. And what happens is this penalty goes not to the federal government, but it goes back to the program. In this case, it goes out to the, back to the benefit of the university. So even if the plan funds are eventually not used for higher education, there's some benefit for the Alaskans that participate, and there's certainly some benefit for the university. Another great advantage of these plans, as set up here under this proposed bill, is they're protected from creditors. If you put the money away for your children's college or other education, you want to be able to make sure that even if you have future financial resources, your child can still continue on with education. So it provides the same kind of protection that the legislature has already provided for IRAs. Now, it's also good for the university, because the university will be able to receive fees for administration and management, and the university gets the penalties for anyone withdrawing and not using the funds for higher education. And finally, it's good for non-Alaskans. And of course, there's always the question, well, why do we care what the non-Alaskans benefit from our program? Well, the reason we care is, again, that Alaska's in competition with every other state to offer the best program, because just as a volume matter, the more funds that flow into the program, the more efficient the program will be and the more benefit to the university. So we need to encourage investment in the Alaska program by non-Alaskans, so the more money under management is a better thing. Now, the reason that it's good for Alaska is that it provides potentially creditor protection. Maine provides creditor protection under these 529 plans, as does Illinois. But because of Alaska's unique trust law, we're able to offer better protection to non-Alaskans on our on the same theory that we offer the self-settled spendthrift trust. And for that reason, we're likely to be in a good position to market this program outside the state of Alaska and, again, benefit the university. And hopefully this will even attract back money that's gone outside of Alaska to other savings programs, because like an IRA, people can roll it over from one program to the other. And so I urge the committee to favorably consider this bill.
Thank you. Representative Davies?
Yeah, I wonder if you could tell us how does the having these programs at the university benefit the university?
Okay, two ways. And again, the actual details and the actual numbers, I expect the university would work out with whoever they selected to administer the program. But the way it usually works is the university gets RFPs from major brokerage houses, and the major brokerage house usually covers the administrative expense and the marketing expense of the program, and also gives the university some percentage or some compensation for that, for in effect being the umbrella that allows this this plan to be set up. The other way the university benefits is the university has penalties come in. So if I go in and invest or put in $50,000 for my child's education, and for whatever reason I ultimately decide to withdraw the money, or the money isn't used for higher education, then the penalty, which again is whatever the university ultimately sets under its program, but could be as low as 10% of the earnings, would go back to the university, and I'd get my initial $50,000, the earnings on that $50,000, less 10% of those earnings, which would go to the university. So the university benefits in those two ways.
Representative Davies has a follow-up.
Thank you. That answered that question, but that brought another one to mind, which is when you pay this penalty and you take the money out, do you then have the entire tax obligation to the IRS at that point? In addition to the penalty?
You certainly have to pay income tax on the increases over that time. And
is the original money that you deposit in this tax exempt or not?
It would be exempt from income tax. There'd be no requirement that you pay income tax on the amount that you put in.
Because you already paid it.
Well, it's post-tax dollars.
Correct.
So you already paid taxes.
Right. Okay, are there other questions? Representative Bundy.
Thank you. Did I understand you to say that the penalty could be as low as 10%? And as high as?
It would be as high as the university would care to set it. And I expect the university would do some very, very careful analysis, because, of course, the university would prefer a relatively high penalty to develop more funds for higher educational purposes. But on the other hand, if the penalty is too high, you're going to scare away participants if they're going to go to Arizona or Maine or somewhere else.
And are you aware of what the penalty would be in Arizona or Maine or somewhere else?
A number of states have gone with the 10% of the earnings. Some states do have 15% of the earnings. Those are the best. I really don't know what the worst are.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
This is Jim Lynch. If I could add anything there, the prepaid tuition programs had substantial penalties for withdrawal. The savings programs that are currently out there are really settling at that 10% level, and it's going to be established by what the market is at this point, I believe.
Mr. Lynch, do you have an idea of what the university would like to see as far as a fee back from the contractor, the administrator?
Actually, that would be done through a competitive public procurement process, basically, and we would see who has what product to offer and what they would pay back. In terms of establishing the program, it's important today, and it's going to be, I think, even more important a couple of years from now, to have programs that have low fee structures. Because, as Mr. Manley indicated, there will be 30 or 40 of these programs competing in the marketplace, you know, a year from now. And part of what's there is really what is your fee structure, so there'll be a lot of emphasis on keeping the fees down and bringing the volume up, making less money on each one, but overall, the objective would be to make more money in the process. So I expect the fees to be low. Currently, I think the representative from TIA Crafts that was on the other day indicated the fees are ranging from a little over 0.5% to up to 1.5% with the main program.
Okay, and was that total fees?
Of that, I know New Hampshire, I think, gets in the neighborhood of 12 or be 0.8% interest, roughly, on the New Hampshire program.
Okay, so the state university itself gets that much, and when you said the half of a percent to 1.5%, I think, that was the total fee charge?
It was a total fee charge, and that covers all of the costs of administration and that the provider has, and advertising costs and brochures and the cost of investing the monies.
Okay. Okay, are there any other questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else on teleconference to testify on the bill? And is there anyone here in Juneau? Okay, seeing none, I didn't have any amendments turned in. So unless anybody has amendments, Representative Bundy?
I don't have an amendment, but I do have a concern I wanted to address and would work with bill sponsors for perhaps a future amendment and just state for the record what my perceptions are, anyway. And I think it's somewhat of ironic timing that this morning the Finance Committee listens to a discussion on privatization, and now here we're going to ask the university, or allow the university, to get into the investment business and take a few points off competing with Smith Barney or whoever. Certainly there are some advantages because of taxes. My concern is that if this is truly for citizens to save money for college and not a fundraiser for the university, then the program should be revenue neutral, and the university should not take a few basis points off the top because they're getting money on the surrender value, and it looks like they're double dipping to me. If we want the university to be in a fundraising, money-making, maybe there's a more direct way we could have them address that. This, I think, is supposed to be helping the citizen and not necessarily making money for the university. So, for the record, from my point of view, this should be revenue neutral, and my support, future support, will depend on it becoming revenue neutral, but I would work with the sponsor to see if we can achieve that.
Okay. Representative Murkowski.
Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you. Representative Bundy and I have had a conversation about this and ways to look at it. We've had a conversation also with Mr. Lynch, and as you know, he was the one that drafted up the fiscal note, and I would be happy to see if we can't work out a way so that it is certainly more revenue neutral than it is at this point in time. It is certainly not the intention, my intention as the sponsor, and I don't think it's the intention of the university, as they come into this program, to view it as a money-making, revenue-generating program for the university. It is not that at all. It is to encourage savings for higher education, and we want to make sure that goal is attained and maintained. So I'm happy to work with Representative Bundy, and we'll be figuring out exactly the mechanics of that.
Representative Bundy.
And a question for Mr. Lynch, if I might. I understand that the current dividend checkoff program is not wildly support it. And if this new program begins with the tax advantage, there's likely to be little future participation in the current program. And what is the university's intent then for the original permanent fund checkoff program?
Actually, the university's intent is to continue that program. Actually, part of what this bill does is it allows modification of the program to make it more competitive with the current market. We would then continue that program and try and build these two together. They serve different purposes, I think, in many respects, for different individuals. And if you take a look at the ACT program with regard to making money on a program, it's really, we built in a lot of things in there for graduation incentive credits with the intent that if earnings were greater than what the costs were to maintain the program, that we would return that money to the participants in the form of graduation incentives. So it took a program that's really a modest earnings program or even a low earnings program as a savings vehicle. And if you can work your way through college and graduate within a period of time, you would have a premium earnings program. And it has been our intent to move forward with that. And we will. In terms of participation, we have over 11,000 participants in the ACT program now. And in terms of any other state, in terms of, there's not a lot of participants, but in terms of percentage of population, is probably higher than any other state in the country in terms of per capita. So at any rate, we intend to maintain the program. What I see here is really, when we talk about making money on this other program, I expect that the savings program, the Higher Education Savings Trust, will very rapidly dwarf the ACT program. But it calls for a common administrative structure, and I would hope that the Higher Education Trust program can carry the ACT program forward, because it really is, it's more targeted to people that are coming to the University of Alaska than going outside, although people can go outside and use the ACT program. But it has a lot of benefits to it, and I think the combination can be very valuable to Alaskans. And it's not intended, at least from our perspective, to be a profit maker, nor is it intended to compete with the private sector. Only states can offer these, and the essential program is going to be outsourced to TIA, Kraft, or Smith Barney, or Fidelity, or someone. In fact, even more so than it is today. Today, we do our record keeping in-house. Record keeping is one of the real nightmares of dealing with the program. And the intent is to take the present $25 million that we have and offer that to TIA, Kraft, or Fidelity, or whoever the sponsor is, initiating the program. And have them take over their record keeping also. So I think it's going to make a good match, and I don't think we are going to compete with the private sector. It's going to be whoever we select as a provider competing with Merrill Lynch and Smith Barney and whoever else is out in the marketplace.
Thank you. Representative Osterman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, I'm assuming that the people who are actively in ACT right now will be able to roll their money into the Higher Education Savings?
The bill provides for that, and that's what we would like to have happen. It will require Internal Revenue Service approval of that happening. Okay. It will require their approval.
All right, thank you. Just as a comment, I had concerns over this since I've read the bill, and we had the meeting the other day on it, over the fact that the ACT program right now is currently being subsidized by basically GF dollars when it running through the University of Alaska. I had originally was going to propose a sunset clause on this new trust to give them an opportunity to pull it together, and if they couldn't do it within a couple of years, then maybe I give the opportunity then for people to get their money back out of it and move on. But with the revenue neutral aspect of it, I may not be that interested in with the sunset, though.
It isn't, this is Jim Lynch, it is intended to be revenue neutral. And if there are earnings in excess of cost, what we will do is utilize those within the program to provide incentives to students to do something with whatever we think we might want them to do, whether that be to go to school in-state or to graduate. Within the ACT program, you know, we provide scholarships. And in terms of scholarships, what we're looking at is almost like starter kits, where you would send all the newborns, really, 4 or 5 credits to get them started thinking about saving for college and get an account open for them. And hopefully they would add to over the years. And the use of those credits would be restricted to the specific individual, and we expect very few of those would ever be used 20 years later, but we would like to get the kids thinking about going to college when they're quite young and their parents thinking about saving. And that's the type of thing that will happen.
Why is there really an issue of determining what to do with revenues in excess of cost? Isn't that just all divided out to the individual accounts?
Revenues never match expenses. There's always one way or the other. It's very difficult to get them to zero.
Right.
And it will be, again, like I say, market driven. No one has any idea what the forfeitures will be on these things when you insert a 10% penalty on withdrawals that are not used for educational purposes. And, you know, we could spend a fortune on actuaries and you wouldn't know which number was right when you got done. Nobody knows what the number is going to be. What we provide for is trying to make sure that there's enough revenue to cover the cost. And if that exceeds it, then what do you do with those with excess revenues? And what we will do is put in some sort of a graduation incentive or an in-state premium or something to that effect.
But are you talking then the revenues that are generated by the withdrawal penalty or the revenues generated by the interest earnings?
I guess from my perspective, it will make no difference. They are both revenues to the program.
Okay, but I guess I don't understand why the revenues off of the interest, once you subtract the fees, don't all accrue to the accounts. That's what happens in my IRA. That's what happens in my stock, you know, funds.
Actually, what's happening in your stock fund and your IRA is there's profits in there for whoever the mutual fund provider is or the broker. There's fees and profits in there, and essentially that's what you're paying, and that's what you would pay here. And this has to be competitive. And the tax advantage nature of the program essentially means that you could pay higher fees in this program and be much better off than you are in after-tax mutual fund program. I really don't think you're talking about great amounts of profit here. We have to get that program up over $100 million to think about breaking even. So there's a big hurdle to cross here to get there. And I think we're going to make it fine.
Okay.
But there's no guarantees with any of this stuff.
Sure. Representative Bundy.
Thank you. Well, of course, we're looking at something that may be in place for 20 or 50 years, and so hopefully that hurdle accomplished long before that. But,
that is one of the reasons why we're interested in the ACT program. It really needs to be modified. We have a responsibility to do that for our participants, and without regard to whatever happens here, I really hope that bringing the two together will make an attractive package that can be marketed together and cover its own costs.
I wanted to ask about a term you've used a couple of times now called graduation incentives. I'm assuming you mean by profit, you mean the cost of administering this money, and if there's some extra that somehow accrues to the university and doesn't stay into the individual's account, you would then use that for a graduation incentive. And what's that?
Basically, if a student graduates within six years, if they send us their transcript as they graduated, we would take the earnings that they made on the program and increase that by 25% or 50% or whatever we determine there's enough revenues to do. It's basically returning the monies back to the participants and trying to give them some incentive to work harder to graduate within a specified period of time. And it gives the participants some control over how good the program is for them.
Okay, any other questions? Seeing none and seeing no, having no amendments, and we do have the fiscal note. Just want to see if people have questions on the fiscal note. Seeing none, what's the will of the committee? Representative Davies?
That we move the bill out of committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note.
Okay, there is a motion to move House Bill 268, the Hess version, from committee with the attached Hess fiscal note with individual recommendations. Any objection?
Comment, Mr. Chairman.
There's a comment from Representative Grusendorf.
Yeah, looking at this scheme here, I guess it meets its purpose. I have no objection to it because the person that's going to look at this is obviously going to make a decision on his own whether or not it fits what they want to do. And it probably would create some discipline in that particular investor in this program in sticking true with what it was he or she intended to do in the beginning. While I don't think I would use this mechanism, I think there might be some people out in the Alaska public that may use it and would direct them to continue to contribute to it. And I'm sure they'd be aware of all the ups and downs and the penalty clauses that connected with it before they went into it. So with that, I can support it. It doesn't tell people they have to do it.
Okay. Any other objection? Seeing none, then the bill will move from committee with individual recommendations. That wraps up our calendar for today. I do have a note just regarding tomorrow's meeting. We have an overview from the Commonwealth North. They've indicated that the Alaska asset portfolio, which they had earlier sent to all of our offices, they don't have enough copies to bring tomorrow to give everybody another copy. So if you could just look in the files that you have in your office and perhaps bring that tomorrow so that we can make sure that everybody does have a copy and perhaps enough for anybody that's in the audience. Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I had the opportunity to read those the other day, and there's some really good points about the distribution of our resource wealth in Alaska. I think it would be good for people to read before they come in to talk with them. So just, I thought it was real interesting.
Like resource assets you're talking about?
Yeah.
Not state equipment?
No, resource assets. And how we don't get a financial return to the general fund for a lot of the things we do in resource development.
Particularly in mining.
So if you could just bring those tomorrow, it would help them out. And with that, we are adjourned for the day.
And finally, getting some from fishing.
You don't have a paddle boat sticker for this program here.
Pardon?
The college
No paddle boat sticker.